Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back, and it is now or never, and I don't know what it's going to take. I do know, and as a matter of fact, I had a really good conversation with a grassroots operator who has been at this for quite a long time, and let me just focus on what we talked about that I think is important. And so in discussing what it takes to actually make something happen, there is this huge analogy that it requires 70%. A huge analogy, I'm sorry. There's a prevailing assertion, and this actually came from, I believe, Flynn. General Flynn. And I believe he's basically saying that America, we need 70% of Americans to actually take a stand. In other words, like an army that has to take a stand. Now, there's this old, I'm not going to get it right, but there's an old prevailing thought that 0.1% is all that is necessary to invoke change. 0.1%. And there have been, if you want to say experiments, I don't want to say studies, but there have been experiments that have actually proven this. And so let's play the numbers game. When we look at the population of America, and we're throwing out this, and we're going to round it down to 300 million Americans. In other words, legitimate citizens. Now, we know it's probably less than that, but let's just keep it down at 300 million. Now, what is 70%, or what is 50% of 300? It's 150 million. So 70% is an astronomically high number, because 10% of 300 million is 30 million, right? So if you add another 60 million on top of 150 million, that gives you 210 million. In other words, General Flynn believes that we need 210 million people to rise up against the left. And I'm saying, are you kidding me? When it comes to democracy, it only takes 50% plus one as far as voting or what have you to make something happen in a democracy. We don't have a democracy, and that's another bone of contention that I have, because it's Feedback Friday, folks. And so when we look at history and how this nation and how other events have occurred by a minority, as a matter of fact, Martin Luther, one man, identified 95 problems, and all he was doing was trying to get the Catholic Church to adopt a more accurate position towards the scriptures. That's all. That's all he was saying. Hey, you've got these problems. And instead, they ignored him, and then eventually they realized that they needed to get rid of him, and it was too late. They couldn't. But one man was successful in a campaign. One man initiated this, hey, there's all these problems, and now, you know, what are we going to do about it? And all he had to do was educate the masses. He only needed to get enough of the monarchies and enough people to start saying, you know what, we've got to move away. Did they have 100%? After 10 years of this, I'll just say, establishing these 95 problems, 10 years later, the Germanic monarchs severed their relationship with the Catholic Church and moved forward in reforming Christianity. So that was one man, and it took 10 years. Now, this has been an evolutionary process. And I just want everybody to understand that out of the gate, I still don't. I'm still learning. I'm going to give you some stuff today when we get into how it takes the two parties to actually allow the seizure, capture, and the elimination of liberty. In other words, one step at a time, they successfully have gotten us this far down the road of taking our liberties. Now, when we look at what it takes for one person to do this, the problem that we see today is, how effective are you when you actually take an effective weapon, a person, and you move them into a battlefield? You place them on a battlefield where nobody can get hurt. And what we have is we have a situation where, regardless of how bloody you get, nothing is going to come of it. And what I mean by this, folks, is when we go into the federal courts to fight the federal government, we're going to lose because that's their battlefield. They own and control it. It's kind of like the home field advantage is really what I'm talking about. And so regardless, every time you have two teams playing, that game is occurring with a home field advantage. Now, Super Bowl, Smooper Bowl, supposedly that's no home field advantage, but it doesn't matter. When you have, and there is evidence, and overwhelming evidence, that when you have a fan base, that can really drive the energy for that team. Now, back to the percentages. Okay, 210 million, according to General Flynn, is what we have to do. And I'm here to tell you he's absolutely wrong. I'm looking at, and I talk to people all the time, I'm looking at the communist movement in America, even though there are a lot of people that have been bamboozled in this idea of democracy, cover this democracy idea that covers the reality of a communist movement in America. And we go, okay, so we have maybe 20% of people that are, active and or at least honest enough to say, this is not legitimate in America. And then you have a good percentage of people, which are your Republicans and Democrats, that kind of just recognize the party process and the party compromise. And that's the process of doing things. Again, going into the paths of resistance. Oh, well, we use the party, the election, and we compromise our way back out of this. And that's what every Republican candidate wants you to do, to vote for them, so that they can go in there and prove to you that they can compromise our way back out of this. Folks, we're being played, because that is a battlefield that we have no control over. And as a matter of fact, they have no desire of fixing the problem. Because the worse the problem gets, the more you beg, and then we need you, and we need more of you. And it grows the team. And they're playing in a field that will, nobody's going to get hurt. How many times have you seen a public servant, other than, when they really, destroy themselves? I mean, it happens when, who was it, Packard? His last name started with a P. I believe he was from Oregon. I think he was a senator, and he had affairs and so forth, and he had to step down. It happens because they destroy themselves because they feel that they're untouchable. I can get away with all this bad behavior. Anyway, back to the numbers, though. This tenth of a percent. What is 1% of 300 million? Well, that's easy, right? 3 million, right? 1% of 100 million would be 1 million. So 1% of 300 is 3 million. So what's one-tenth of that? 3 million. What is 1/10? That would be 300,000. I'm hoping all my math is right, because I know some mathematician listening to me is going, he made a mistake there. So 300,000. If we have 300,000 people in America that understand the Constitution and understand the tools and what we have and how unconstitutional all of this stuff is, and that the problem cannot be resolved through compromise, it cannot be resolved through the courts, that right there is the dangerous point. That right there is the, and how realistic is it in America? I want you to think about this. How many people are identified and how many vote for Republicans? In 2020, how many people voted for Trump? What, 70-some million? So do you think we can get 300,000 Republicans that, you know, are really seeking the truth to actually, or let's just call them conservatives? Better yet, how many people are in the Constitution Party? Go back to the 2020 election. How many people actually voted for the Constitution Party nominee or the Libertarian Party nominee? You see my point? There's more than enough people out there. And as we move and as we continue to progress, because folks, we're coming close to 20. I'm hoping within a month we'll pass the 20 mark on petitions. Which, what that's doing is it's derailing me from being able to finish Why Counties Matter Most. So I've got a lot of work to do. I've only got so much time, and I only have so many hands and fingers to be able to type and work on things. And so this is why we need your help. To get to the point where we have enough energy, 300,000, to where we can actually start inflicting pain and damage to all of these people, or actually, because I honestly believe that it's just, that begins the point of really awakening. Now, last year I did a series on, the, you know, if you voted for me, if we had a constitutional president, what a difference that constitutional president would make. You need to revisit that. You need to revisit those shows. I think it's like 12, 15, something like that. But one of the things that we can tell you right now is the president's primary job is to ensure the faithful execution of the laws. And when we say of the laws, we're talking about the constitutional laws. Now, we hear a lot of people talking about Section 3 of the 14th Amendment and how states are using that to ban Trump from the, and I'm not here as a Trump fan. I don't look at Trump as the big problem out of all the candidates that we have. I can tell you right now, and I've said this before, Nikki Haley and Vivek Ramaswamy are not natural born citizens. They're not. I don't even think they naturalized. Whether that's true or not, I know that they're not naturally born citizens. And this is my point, that a constitutional president has the authority. He can use his Department of Justice to go after every congressman who has violated their oath. And who is that? Ilhan Omar, or whatever her name is, the lady that spoke up in the House of Representatives speaking on behalf of the Somali government and the Somali people, that she was there to protect them. She literally violated her oath of office, her allegiance, and her job is to support the Constitution and nothing else. And when she places another nation, that's her speech is treasonous, but more importantly, her speech was, her attitude is an indictment, but her speech truly indicted her for violating her oath of office. That was absolute moral perjury. She should be removed from office. And Trump, or any constitutional president, can use the Department of Justice to go in and pull people and actually remove them and place them into, if you want to call it, let's just call it a suspension. In other words, you can't be functioning as a politician, and you have every right to try to basically appeal this action, but you absolutely have to have evidence to override. So this is where a common law, because I don't think they'll invoke, but they will invoke a grand jury, boom, 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 get these indictments and literally move forward and remove every member of Congress, every member, Rand Paul, Cruz, all of these people, because not one of them has been stating and demanding compliance to the Constitution. So one at a time, as they start getting rid of these folks, there's messages going back to every state saying you need to replace your people. You got to replace these guys because none of them have, you know, they're all ineligible to serve. And see, go read Section 3 because this is the interesting part. Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, for that, if you get banned from public service, there's only one way to be able to become a public servant again. You need 2/3 of both houses of Congress to approve that removal from you. Now, if we remove everybody from Congress and all of these congressmen come to Congress and beg, hey, reinstate me, let me become a public servant again, what they're basically doing is they would be voting or allowing these people to come back and get back into that office. How many replacements that go into Congress are thinking that's a good thing to do? Probably all of them. There may be some diehard, you know, loyalists or what have you out there. But bottom line, the point is that the number of 300,000 is just a number that has been fixated on my mind. And I think that number is probably a little bit less. But bottom line, folks, that is a huge impact nationwide. And when you look at your state, put that into proportion of what you need in your state. Shoot, if you just divide it by 50, what does that come to, right? Right? And so it's a lot less. It's a lot less of what you need in your state. And I honestly think that we're now working in a realm because you if you're not living in California, you're not living in one of those more popular states, you're probably somewhere in the 10,000. You need 10,000 people to demand compliance to the Constitution. And how do we do this? This is why petition campaigns can do this. This is why we need to actually marry up these petitions and this movement to political candidates. Why you need to start thinking about either running or finding a person that is an advocate for the Constitution and actually be willing to sign a pledge that they will never violate their oath of office. They will fully and wholeheartedly support the Constitution and attack anybody in office that is violating their oath. More importantly, that they will do everything possible to obtain full compliance of the Constitution's in every way as these discoveries come forward out of a federal review process and out of republic review. Here's a question. How can this be a bad thing? How can a conservative organization out there say, this is a bad thing, we can't have this, we need to get you to just call your congressman and stop that bill? We need you to actually go out and get convince your state to nullify federal law. And you know who I'm talking about because you know who I like railing about. But let's move on. We've been talking about how it requires two parties for a political system to successfully strip liberties, for a political system that is not a part of our government, but a political system that can slowly and incrementally assume more and more power and take more and more power from the states and more power from the people. That is done through what we perceive is this political compromise that the two parties agree. In other words, I am submitting to you folks that it took both parties to work together to basically push their agenda in taking away your liberties and moving us down this path of this globalism and this global world. And so when we look at where the money comes from and all of these different people, this is not just a single person that is out there. It's one single evil person that has this big trough of money and is buying everybody. This is a collective effort of evil people, evil corporations that have all kind of got joined into this gang, into this pool of evil. And they're using their money to ensure that these people always move forward their agenda. And they're given a little bit of leeway to go ahead and say bad things about this and vote against it. And this is how our politicians get rich. You need to watch The Swamp. But as I've submitted to you, we talked about the Assumption Act and how it literally took two parties to allow that to happen. And we've covered the Assumption Act and how James Madison was convinced by Tom Jefferson. And, you know, this probably weighed on them for a long time, but they got over it. But the bottom line is they were duped by Alexander Hamilton in allowing the federal government to violate the Constitution. Now, this is the one thing I don't understand is why didn't they initiate this interposition that they did in 1798? We'll never get these answers until we, you know, cross that threshold. But the fact of the matter is that it was a violation of the Constitution for the federal government to assume debt for the states. It's not in the Constitution for them to do that. They can assume debt in doing their functions of, you know, those delegated powers if they have to go to war or what have you, but they just can't come along and say, hey, states, we're going to take over your debt. And the way they play, but why did the states let this happen? Because the states benefited. In other words, the federal government, almost out the gate in 1790, instantly reached out to the states and said, we want to corrupt you. Are you corruptible? Yeah, sure. Take this debt from us. And they actually expanded that in the application of what we call the Assumption Act. So, because every other state benefited. And these other states actually said, yeah, you can't do that. You can't do that. But they ended up benefiting as well. Now, down the road, we saw that the bank and other things were being done by political compromise. How is it that they created a national bank in 1792 without political compromise? And this infuriated Madison and Jefferson so much, and they didn't even see this coming. They were complicit, and they contributed to the justification for a national bank when the federal government assumed the debt with the Assumption Act. In other words, it set the stage for Hamilton to come forward with this idea of creating a bank. Now, it has come forward as well that Hamilton was operating as a spy. Whether that's true or not, I will let you decide. I haven't seen the data. I've only seen a picture of a document that alluded to this. But here's my point. If Hamilton was a spy, he was really operating very well outside of everybody else's knowledge, because there would have been documents that would have come across that would have actually supported, not documents of a foreign nature, but documents in America that would have come across as people, you know, either suspecting and or finding out or what have you about a ring of spies in America. So in other words, this was a very slow process of penetrating our American government with the British spy network. So we're going into a break. I didn't even see this happening. So when we go into this break, we'll be coming back. And I'm going to be then turning focus towards how they started actually implementing laws, and the Alien Sedition Acts was literally that point, and how it seemed like a single party had taken over and a new party was arising. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so in the beginning, we actually, and I talked about this, how the anti-federalists and the federalists were clearly divided. And over time, it seemed like the federalists had this big surge of obtaining, you know, these seats. But that wasn't true. As a matter of fact, the majority of those who were elected, at least the Senate, because who controlled the Senate and the seating of the Senate? Well, the state legislatures. The state legislatures were the part of the cabals, right? So we know that Virginia wasn't going to send Federalists. They actually sent anti-Federalists, and Henry made sure that Virginia sent anti-Federalists. So the majority of the seats that were being filled were being filled by anti-Federalists in the Senate. In the House of Representatives, it kind of broke down to be what was perceived as possibly Federalist, anti-Federalist, what have you. But it didn't take long for everybody to convert to Federalists. I point to you the issue of the Bill of Rights when Madison, in the very first month of the very first session of Congress, Madison came forward and says, I want to, you know, I'm here to basically work on and submit a Bill of Rights for this assembly to pass for amendments to the Constitution out to the states. And so what ended up happening is he got a bunch of pushback from all of these people in the room. Hey, this is, you know, it's not time to amend it. Let's kick the tires on this thing. Let's operate it for a few years, and then we'll figure out if it needs amending. What the heck happened? You know, what the heck happened? So it seemed like, you know, we had all of these Federalists take over, and then all these anti-Federalists that came in. And even Madison even got flack from the anti-Federalist senators from Virginia. Why are you doing this? So my point is this, folks, that as soon as people, you know, get elected, they gravitate into a new position of power, they instantly try to figure out how they can have an advantage. They instantly try to figure out how this can benefit them more. How can I use this to benefit? In other words, they instantly begin seeking and exercising unrighteous dominion. It's just a natural tendency for people to do that. As a matter of fact, I point out that a natural tendency of human, because people talk about how divided we are today. We're just as divided as they were back then. The only difference is we're divided in so many different ways. And we allow ourselves to get, you know, divided more and more and more and more. If you boiled it down, you would probably, you know, if we boiled it down to the core division of people today, it would be good versus evil. And then people would find that, wow, there's a lot of gray in between this good versus evil. In other words, there's a huge body of people that are a little bit, you know, good and a lot evil, or, a lot good and a little evil. In other words, when you really look at the scale of liberty going from pure liberty, where, you know, you cannot imagine anybody being compelled. Everybody needs to make their own decisions. Everybody is sovereign, and they have sovereignty over themselves. All the way down this line to where everybody must be forced. Everybody must be compelled. Everybody is subjugated, and that a collective will control everything instead of actually having the freedom of choosing for yourself what to do. In other words, when we look at our government, our political system, and when we look at the philosophies of men, it really is just nothing but a huge amount of subdivisions from one point of liberty to the point of subjugation. So when you hear these brilliant minds of philosophy, even today, of what's his name, Peterson, I forget his first name, but and you know I'm bad with names. But the point is that you hear these people talk, and they're brilliant in analyzing down into the minutiae. In other words, they're really good at drilling down, and it seems like they can even give you the big picture. But it's not as complicated as they say it is, and so it's not genius either. We're equally divided today as they were then. It is human nature to find a way to divide. It is it is the carnal nature of man to constantly be dividing, being contentious, and trying to, create your own power bases. That's the carnal man. Again, it boils down to good and evil. So when we looked at how the two parties started working together, what ended up happening is that the parties gravitated towards more power. They got past the Bill of Rights because actually Virginia and New York, with their petitions for a constitutional convention, that helped Madison get that. But there were all of these little issues that were starting to pop up. That, the government wants to actually spend money on doing things that they don't really have the authority to do. And Madison kept on schooling them. We're going to go through those documents. But what you need to understand is it got to a point by 1798 that there were so many anti-federalists, they began pouring a foundation to silence their opposition. Because the Alien and Sedition Acts were really trying to do that. They're trying to get rid of foreigners who came here who were wanting to become either U.S. citizens or being engaged in America. And so the Alien and Sedition Act was trying to basically push out these people coming in that were really probably favorable towards the cause of liberty. They wanted to get rid of certain people like the French that were coming here that wanted liberty. And they wanted to actually bring in more people that were friendly to subjugation, monarchy, and this movement towards big government, because they were basically in control and they wanted to make sure that they brought those people who supported what they wanted to do. And they passed a law regarding the Sedition Act that actually said, if you speak out against us, we will arrest you. So the Alien Sedition Act seemed to be that one thing that just made Madison and Jefferson go into hyperboil. I mean, they just woo, and they were saying that this is the beginning of the end. And so what they ended up having to do is they had to create and reach back to the Republican Party that they created in 1792 and actually use that in creating a national campaign on liberty. So this was the real first visible struggle, because before, what was happening wasn't really the opposition of sides. It was a conversion of one cabal into the bigger cabal. So that was all like this conversion of anti-federalists into the federalists. And there were people that just said, you know what, We're all for a limited government, and slowly but surely the Hydra started showing its head, or this Leviathan started showing its head, that they wanted more power and they were going to take it. And they were going to do what they needed to by using political compromise to do it. So the Alien Sedition Act was a huge wake-up call saying, hey, you know, this party, this unopposed party, is actually taking us down the wrong road. And so this wake-up of the second party occurred. Now, we did at this point in time, we really didn't have the two parties starting to compromise. They weren't starting to work together. And what ended up happening is, as we walk through some of these next steps, you'll actually see how the party starts to corrupt itself, because these bad people get into it like rhinos. When you have nothing but Republicans ruling, the rhinos come in, and next thing you realize is that, you know, this is not a single party system. We've got a party that has been infiltrated again. And that's exactly what happened in America, the very first few iterations. So when we go through the Alien Sedition Acts of 1798, we see the Republican Party move forward in annihilating and basically obscuring the Federalists. They died. I mean, they became, you know, obsolete. What ended up happening, the individuals didn't become obsolete, but the public acknowledgement of this party and this paradigm was folded into the Republican Party. And it didn't take long until they started assuming powers at the federal level that was in violation of the Constitution and in violation of the Republican Party paradigm. So how is it that the prevailing party is now doing things that they actually spoke out against? And the one point in time where this really became evident was in 1816 with the Indiana Enabling Act. Here's a state that's supposed to join the Union with equal footing. However, there were some clauses that cause pause. In other words, there were clauses that you actually say, hold on, state. You know, you're a sovereign state and you're joining this union with equal footing, but we're telling you that you have some resources that we consider national resources, like your salt mines. So, and this is all in my article on Why Counties Matter Most. I start to go through this to show how the federal government started overreaching under the Republican umbrella. It didn't take long for it to even get worse. When Missouri came into the Union in 1820, we had this new compromise called the Missouri Compromise. In other words, D.C., the party in D.C., which was the Republican Party, but by this time it was infiltrated. It was, again, a bunch of rhinos where these progressives had stepped in, or these people who supported slavery and supported this continuation of this practice instead of actually allowing slavery to become outmoded. In other words, where we would just walk away from it completely. That was what was happening. And these people recognized this. Those who were out to protect and prolong slavery in America and actually to preserve it permanently, they recognized that slavery was in real jeopardy if Missouri joined the Union on their own accord. So they not only were playing with, you know, taking land and withholding land and so forth in the beginning of 1816, in 1820, they actually dictated to the state, the federal government dictated to the state of Missouri, and that all states henceforth that joined the Union that is south of a very specific latitude on the face of the earth or in the continental United States, if you're a state and you're in this latitude or below, you will be a slave state. They didn't have any constitutional authority to do that. However, they had enough people and they had enough lawyers to agree. This is where the legal system, the lawyers, and this corrupt legal system actually started pushing forward. You have to understand that the legal system itself thrives when you have contention. Have you ever heard this paradigm that, you know, when it comes to disagreements, the only side that wins every time is what we call the neutral side or the legal side. In other words, your side, you know, the plaintiff and the defendant, one of those two will be the loser, but the parties representing them, the lawyers, never lose. Does the lawyer ever go to jail? No. Each side actually makes money. Each side of the opposition, of the contention on the legal side is protected, and they make money. And so it becomes a win to get more and more contention, more and more people going into the legal system and hiring lawyers. And so why would, in a nation of common law, why would there be a big push for the legal system to have professional lawyers making money all the time and actually start to inflict that? Where would that come from? Who would benefit from having a system of common law move and graduate into this thing we call, you know, the admiralty courts or the professional courts where lawyers actually start making money? In other words, now you're employing lawyers on a regular basis instead of people actually going up and saying, hey, this is wrong, and making an appeal to a jury of their peers saying, I was wronged, and presenting the evidence. Oh, well, you can't do that. You need a lawyer to do that now. And then they came up with the saying, only a fool, you know, a fool, you know, what is it, a fool represent himself, or only a fool, or the something like a client being represented by themselves, you know, has a fool for an attorney. Something like that. Most of you will probably be able to just recite that. But the fact of the matter is we were bamboozled into allowing this overreach of a legal system to actually control us. And we've been none the wiser the whole time. They've actually made the rules so that you can't represent yourself and that our courts are no longer common law courts. When did the court system and when did the federal government just bow to civil law? And this is the institution of civil law and instituting case law in America. When did that happen? 1837. So in other words, our legal system was basically allowed to be compromised in 1837, because there were enough corrupt politicians in America that allowed basically, and this was done by the court, this 1837 announcement that we're going to institute these rules. It was called the court rules. They established their own rules that they were going to start using case law. In other words, if you use case law, now you actually have to understand all of these different cases. How do you do that? You got to go to court, or actually you got to go to court college to learn and understand case law and precedents. Well, why are they doing that? Why were they invoking that in common law? It was the invoking of civil law, and that's what ended up really happening, folks. This is how we were sold out by a monopoly of a prevailing party, or I should say how a prevailing party, because who was the party in at 1837? That was the Democratic Party. And it was under, I believe, Martin Van Buren, a lawyer in the North who was absolutely a diehard supporter for slavery. If we look at how all of this stuff was really unraveling, the establishment and the permanency of a two-party system was just a couple of decades away. I mean, literally a couple of decades away, because in 1832, this is where we finally standardized the Electoral College. In other words, we convinced the states to turn their backs towards appointing their own Electoral College. And I've already kind of covered this, and I cover this in Why Counties Matter Most. But if you start looking at how this, instead of going to one party being infiltrated by, you know, bad players, they actually went back and forth and said, you know what, we would get far, we would be able to advance more efficiently if we actually had two permanent parties, and we went back and forth in contrast and basically utilize compromise, because this way we don't necessarily have to worry about, you know, the delay of a 10 to 15 year period when a party kind of takes over, because all of a sudden the political mood of America swings towards republicanism and then it swings towards democracy. Well, now having two parties, what it facilitates is a constant ability for the parties to compromise. So it doesn't matter really what side of the aisle you're on. You're going to compromise your way this way or compromise your way that way. And that's how that was invoked. That's how the court system, because there were enough lawyers on both sides, the court system basically co-opted our common law system. And from that point forward, the death of common law was, you know, on this path. The path of taking us completely away from common law had been established. It's just like I tell you, when the day you create a police force is the day you create the argument that the people don't need to have guns. Remember, our system was designed where we, the people, had to enforce and execute the laws of the Union. Why and how? Because Congress is to call up the militia. Who's the militia? We the people. And everybody has this responsibility of serving. Those people who want to serve and do serve so, you know, full time, well, you know, they're out there doing that. But when it comes to the actual service, anybody can be called up. At least they create laws of who that is. And today that's everybody between, what, age 17 and 60 or 50 or whatever that is. And it varies from state to state, but bottom line, it doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter, because we see that they have created their own executions. In other words, they've completely turned their back on our militia system, and that they know that the states will never use the militia. If you think that what's going on that southern border is a shift in paradigms, no. Because the states still haven't stood up and said the National Guard is not a constitutional system. When the states start dismantling the National Guard and go back to a full-fledged militia that is deployed out of every county in every state, now we're talking. Because I get these questions all the time. How is it? How is it that along that border, we don't have sheriffs and militias actually deployed? Because many of those counties, they don't even have the population to do that, because the state has failed to actually establish and make sure that there are people along that border. The state should have been doing this a long time ago. But when the Dick Act of 1903 occurred, this is when they actually usurped that. But I'm jumping ahead of myself. Again, the Dick Act was a political compromise of how the federal government was going to co-opt and pervert our militia system. And that's exactly what they did. But let me get back to this timeline. So in 1816, that was the point in time where we saw the federal government shift with a bunch of rhinos, and this is where they started aggrandizing. And it was just incrementally, we're just telling Indiana that they can't permanently sell those salt mines, that they have to basically hold those as state property instead of letting the state make that decision themselves. The federal government did not have the authority to tell them to do that. The Missouri Compromise again in 1820. Now, the next one that we're diving into is the gag rule. And I'm kind of bypassing some things like the first subsidies of the railroad and so forth. But I want to dive into the gag rule because I have this to read for you, because I got about 4 minutes. And this is actually out of the Senate record. You can read this, but this is really telling. It says this: few members in the Senate of 1836 cared, very few, cared about abolishing slavery in the District of Columbia, yet they faced two options. One was to accept the petitions and then bury them in a committee. You got to see, at this point in time, they were using First Amendment petitions. And so what they said was, okay, we can accept the petitions and bury them in a committee. This procedure preserved the basic right of citizens to petition their government while protecting the interest of members from the slave states. John C. Calhoun believed it was time to end this hypocrisy. Under his plan, the Senate would accept no anti-slavery petitions. In his opinion, Congress had no business considering emancipation. If that issue ever reached the floor of the Senate or the House, there would be no end to it, and it would shake the Union at its foundations. Most senators wanted this irritating issue to disappear. They feared that Calhoun's proposal to bar the Senate door to these petitions would inadvertently benefit the small and regional isolated anti-slavery movements. Overnight, the troublesome enemies of slavery could be transformed into noble champions of civil liberties. In other words, they were thinking politics. They were looking at what these outcomes could be, and they go, how do we avoid these types of outcomes? So after rejecting Calhoun's plan on March 16th of 1836, the Senate devised a curious, complex, and obscure delaying procedure. It would vote not on whether to receive the petition itself. This would dignify the petition, but on whether to accept the question of receiving the petition. This indirect method produced enough confusion to provide political cover for all members regardless of their position. It was a classic example, a quarter century before the Civil War, of postponing the inevitable. But the gag rule was instituted where they created this facade that, yeah, you could petition, but they just didn't talk about it. It got buried. These were petitions, First Amendment petitions, to government for the redress of grievances. This was the beginning of a very fundamental constitutional right that we the people have in our self-government. And they started burying one type of petition. Eventually, they got to a point and said, you know what? We do a lot better when we don't have the people in our knickers. We've got to come up with and devise a way to get people to believe that their right isn't to actually hold us accountable, but their right is to rally and go out into the streets and protest. We need to invoke civil unrest and what basically became the civil disobedience. In other words, when we started looking at how people were applying their pressure, it was civil disobedience in the civil arena. In other words, outside of the halls of government, people started going out and they started getting arrested. Civil disobedience. The communist movement in the early 1900s was one of those very specific things. As a matter of fact, many of these revolutions and protests for labor and everything else that was driven by communism, collectivism in America, this started in the early 1800s. Anyway, when we come back next Friday, we're going to dive more into all of this whole process of how the two parties have been successful in taking away our liberties and ratcheting their power. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org. And let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.